Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're joined now by John Mualim, science writer who's written for the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, WNYC's own Radiolab. He's got a new book about conservation efforts and our changing relationship with the animal world. It's called Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. John Mualim, welcome back to WNYC, and you get the long subtitle award for the week.
Thank you very much. I was trying to pack it all in there, I guess.
One of the main characters in this book, along with all the animals you encounter, is your daughter. And you started thinking about this when you noticed all of the animals that surround your daughter in her daily life. Describe that for us and why it sort of surprised you.
Yeah, well, I think like most parents, you know, we had a baby and suddenly our house was just filling up with animals, you know, stuffed animals or animals on bibs, animals on plates, animals on sippy cups. It seems like anything for kids, they like to slap animals on these things. And it just sort of occurred to me, you know, how bizarre that is. As one conservationist put it to me, you know, just as someone's learning to be human, we're surrounding them with animals. And I really started to think, because at the same time I was starting to do reporting about wildlife conservation for the Times Magazine, and just really getting a look at how dire but also complicated the predicament of so many species in North America are right now. Not just that they're going extinct or that they're losing their habitat, but that the lengths that we're going right now to prop them up in place and the intensity of these kind of hands-on management schemes and interventions we're doing to keep the world around them rigged in place, and just how different that actual animal world is from the sort of innocent, more romantic world that we show to our children, and which I think, frankly, speaking for myself at least, I think, you know, I buy into that image too of wildlife just being these autonomous creatures out there just getting along fine on their own that have nothing to do with us.
I imagine that the toothpaste manufacturer who's putting a polar bear on the handle of their toothbrush is at some level thinking, this is good. I'm teaching these kids to love animals, which is a good thing for society. Are you saying that's not working or may even be counterproductive?
I don't know. I mean, I think what I'm saying is that there's basically these two universes of animals that we are in touch with. You know, one is this actual ecological world, and the other is the one actually that most of us are more in touch with, which is this kind of fantasy world of how we think nature and wilderness ought to be or actually are. And just finding myself straddling those two worlds, you know, it was sort of jaw-dropping. So I wanted to kind of go out into the real world and kind of compare the way we think about animals to what's actually happening out on the land. And even more importantly, realizing that in an age of what they call conservation reliance, where animals are really reliant on our activities and our empathy for their survival, they're not going to survive unless we go out there and help them survive. Those stories that we tell about animals and the way we understand or misunderstand their place on Earth is really an ecological force. It's really shaping the planet, and it's either letting them survive or letting them go to their extinction.
And I was fascinated by your research into how quickly our relationship with nature has changed. You describe how just 100 years ago, animals were everywhere, stories of huge flocks of passenger pigeons blocking out the sun in the middle of the day, things like that. But I guess your point is, and we can talk about this as a new vocabulary word for the day, we're living in the Anthropocene epoch. Did I say it right?
Yeah, you know, I've heard it Anthropocene and Anthropocene. Either way, I'd say Anthropocene.
Which means there have been ice ages, there have been land mass shifts, there have been periods of global warming, but the defining characteristic of this era as Anthropocene or Anthropocene, it's the effect of humans on the planet.
Exactly. I mean, you know, our species has pretty much taken over the place, right? So just as our activities and our presence is causing extinction, the flip side of that is that really our effort is going to be the thing that saves animals. We have to be out there. I mean, right now there's just a huge kind of, you know, very quietly, this huge, massive project to protect animals across America that really I had no idea about. I mean, I feel like I'm, you know, I'm into animals. I watched, you know, PBS shows growing up, like Wild America. Mm-hmm. But I had no idea that we're doing things like, you know, monitoring pygmy rabbits with drones, or shooting barred owls to make room for spotted owls in the forest, or carrying migrating salamanders across highways so they can continue safely on their migration. I mean, this is really what it takes to keep this semblance of wildlife in the world, and it's completely opposite, I think, the sentimental idea of wildness that most of us, you know, walk through the world thinking is out there.
And in your first chapter, you describe efforts to save the polar bear, humans managing the first the threat to extinction and threat of extinction, and then the attempt to save the polar bear, and how that iconic image of the polar bear on a floating piece of ice was supposed to have a huge impact on the climate change debate, but it really hasn't. I mean, climate change politics is no longer about the polar bear losing its habitat. It's about parts of downtown Brooklyn getting flooded. So are animals getting left out of the climate change conversation, or were they just only supposed to be, you know, heartstring tugging representatives of what was going to threaten everybody anyway?
Well, that was it exactly. I mean, I think I go in the book, there's a really complicated but kind of amazing, you know, legal story of why the polar bear became this icon for climate change. And it was, you know, it was pretty purposeful on the part of some shrewd environmentalists and even marketers to use the bear as a cuddly kind of mascot, you know, something that, you know, climate change is this really terrifying thing that's happening. And how can we get people to both internalize something so abstract and then care and be motivated to act? And it seemed like taking a kind of cuddly animal like the polar bear, something that was sympathetic and at just sort of a level of remove from us, was going to be the trick. It was going to be this kind of rallying point. And, you know, what I found when I went to this town, Churchill, Manitoba, which is just south of the Arctic Circle by the Hudson Bay, this is a place where polar bears, which are normally pretty solitary animals, all congregate in one place at the same time every year. So it's really, it's a tourist destination. It's the place where environmentalists or celebrities want to go or need to go if they want to film polar bears. It's just sort of a one-stop shop for everything polar bear these days. Really what you're finding is an argument about climate change centered around the bear, and you're actually finding environmentalists having to kind of safeguard the image of the polar bear to make sure that when journalists or celebrities come up there to talk about polar bears, they're trying to tell the right story and still trying to tell this story as the bear as a symbol of climate change. In some ways, the polar bear has completely lost any other identity at this point. It's always signaling the same thing to everyone.
Speaking of the bear, here's a little pushback from Steve in the Bronx. Steve, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I think the issue of black bears, there was just a thing. They've taken a census. Let's take northwest New Jersey between north of Route 80 and west of Route 287. That's about a quarter of northern New Jersey. There are now 3,000 black bears because there's an overabundance of their favorite food called garbage, and they're all over the place.
Right. And so there are still examples that we could point to like that, John, where humans are still terrified of animals and haven't completely controlled them to the extent that we think we are in charge.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, the black bears, I actually grew up in that area. That's a really interesting case, and I think you see cases like this around the country with different species, and this is something I talk about in the book. There's this kind of cycle that happens where, you know, we nearly obliterate a species, which is the case with black bears in the Northeast, and because, you know, we're afraid of them or they pose some kind of threat or just an inconvenience. And then, you know, over the past 3, 4, 5 decades, we've done a lot to bring these animals back, and now they're coming back. And the odd thing is we don't quite know what to do with them now that we're here. And you see, especially with things like cougars or wolves, you see the emotional attachment to these animals shift or even flip and do a 180 too. You know, there's a case in, I talk about the book, in Southern California with mountain lions where they were nearly gone, and there was a study done where they showed every mention of mountain lions in the LA Times. And when there are no mountain lions around, mountain lions are being discussed as these poetic symbols of wilderness and, you know, kind of our natural heritage. And then as soon as they start rebounding and, you know, they kill a couple dogs, suddenly they're described in the newspaper as, you know, stealthy murderers waiting for your kids.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, yeah, it's really more and more I found that
we're all over the place.
our connection to these animals is really much more subjective than I think we usually think they are.
Well, we've been speaking with John Mooallem, science writer who has written Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. And before you go, we want to mention this collaboration that you have with the band Black Prairie. They wrote an album inspired by your book. It's called Wild Ones, a musical score for the things that you might see in your head when you reflect on certain characteristics and incidents that you read about in the book. I'm not sure whose subtitle is longer, yours or theirs. But from a modern media landscape perspective, does this mean that it's no longer enough just to write a book? You also have to have online videos, live shows, musical collaborations in order to get your story out there?
Oh, I don't know if you have to. I mean, it sure is fun, though. I mean, we've actually done some shows together where they've, orchestrated stories I've told from the book, and it's just a heck of a lot of fun. Whether you need to, I don't know. I guess we'll see.
So we'll go out on a little Black Prairie from the album Wild Ones. You can listen to the full album, folks, on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, and guess what? John Mooallem and Black Prairie will be at City Winery, which happens to be right across from the station, on July 29th. More info about that on our site. John, we're going to listen to a little bit, and thanks so much. You made us all think.
Thanks.